G'day folks, talk to Jamie Lowe, the General Manager of Communications for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS, and unpacked it from where it started, where it is now, and where it's looking at going into the future. Good yarn, great talk. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs. Oh,
yeah. Hi Jamie, how are you?
Oh, hi Jake, I'm great.
Thanks a lot for, you know, sitting down and having a yarn with us about the National Disability Insurance Scheme, second biggest reform in Australia.
Oh, you stole my key line. That's quite right. It is the second biggest social reform since Medicare.
Yeah.
And it's really, really important. So I'm always glad to have the chance to sit down and have a chat about the NDIS.
Yep.
Because it's important. And I like talking about it and sharing the experience with others.
That's great. And just want to jump into first before we talk about the actual scheme, just about yourself and your role within the NDIA and how that all works.
Yeah, so I'm the General Manager of Communications, and it means that I do get to go around and talk about the NDIS. My team's also responsible for producing a lot of the documents, the website material, and a lot of the information that people, it's often their first exposure to the NDIS is material that my team has produced. I've been in the NDIS for 18 months, but my son is a participant, so my experience with the agency goes back much further. Mm. My son has been in the scheme since it was rolled out in the ACT as a trial site in 2013.
Yep.
So I've had a longer history with the NDIS from the participant and carer side of things, but now 18 months in the agency itself.
That's great, you know, having that look of, you know, from that side of participant, you know, you being the mother of the child of someone that's going through the scheme itself, but also working in it and sitting on both sides of the fence and, you know, really seeing how that works,
like, yeah,
from at home to then obviously being at work and trying to formulate that as best as you can. So that's great. And talking about formulating the NDIS, the concept, where it started and where it come from.
Yeah.
Would you be able to elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, for a really long time, I think there was a lot of understanding, particularly for people that lived with disability and their families and carers, that the disability support system in Australia wasn't great. Insufficient funding, inconsistent approach to accessing that funding. That wouldn't have been new information for people that had been living with a disability for a long time. But in 2010, the government commissioned the Productivity Commission to run an inquiry. And I think that was a really important milestone in the evolution of the NDIS, because it was a recognition by government that something dramatic had to happen. There had to be a big change. The government accepted the recommendations of the Productivity Commission that we build a new scheme that was focused on insurance principles. And in 2013, the NDIS commenced in trial sites in a number of spots around Australia. I think it's really important that we remember that all Australian governments, so state and territory governments as well as the federal government, mm-hmm, all came to the same conclusion that something had to change, that there had to be a big difference made to the lives of people with disability. So it became a truly national scheme, and that doesn't happen too often. You know, a social reform of this scale that has bipartisan agreement, so agreement
of
all sides of parliament, it's extraordinary.
Mm. And the actual model of it, the concept and the framework, the structure, the whole kit and caboodle. So where was that brought from? Were there obviously ideas and concepts from overseas where it was brought over to formulate that and the people behind that to build its foundation to what it is now. So where was all that, the thought processes brought from?
Yeah, you know, there was certainly consideration of overseas models, but we can't really see that there is any model overseas that really replicates what we have with the NDIS. I think probably a more similar model is actually our own Medicare system. So it's a similar social insurance model. The NDIS, the way it was ultimately constructed, really reflected a lot of feedback that the Productivity Commission received from people with disability, their families, carers, disability sector. I think they received about 1,000 submissions during their inquiry. And so it was that, you know, that really direct feedback from people that were living with disability that really influenced how the NDIS was set up initially. And that continues to be the case now. We continue to change and evolve and improve. And, you know, that's really primarily in response to feedback we get from participants, their families and the sector.
And talking about improvement, because you're going back to, say, the board, and, you know, where they have overall direction of and a big say of what's going forward with the scheme itself. So who are the board members and what's their expertise?
Yeah. So there are 11 members of the board, and the board provides advice to government, so it advises the minister and has, you know, an oversight, a strategic oversight role with respect to the agency. And the board members come from a really diverse range of backgrounds, and that's actually been true ever since we've had a board. So it hasn't mattered really which board members we're talking about. As a group, they've always had a really diverse background. So we've got people from the disability sector, so with experience from the disability sector, finance and insurance. We have members of the board that have disability themselves or are carers of people with disability. So the background's really diverse. And I think that's what you would expect from a board that's, you know, that's required to cast a pretty critical eye over the work we're doing and give independent advice to government about how we're tracking.
Yeah, it's great having that, all the different facets of, you know, whether it is people with lived experience or, what, you know, like yourself, or if it's someone that has a child with disability, and, you know, all the other different people with different expertise, you know, or if it's got to do with health or, you know, professionals, where it's doctors or whatever it may be that are in the disability sector, or just, you know or have a good foundation of where the scheme should go, expertise-wise, and that's critical. And talking about critical, so you got the Standing Council on Disability Reform and the Independent Advisory Council. So apart from the minister, with the other two bodies made up, so you have a few of the people within these two bodies, they do have people with lived experience of disability too, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. So the Standing Council of Disability Ministers is a meeting, or it's a grouping of ministers from the states and territories, as well as the federal minister, who have responsibility for disability. And so they come from a range of backgrounds, you know, in the same way that you would expect politicians or ministers to represent a variety of backgrounds. The Independent Advisory Committee, though, it's required that the committee have members, that at least half the members have disability themselves.
That's good.
Yeah, and that at least two members are carers and have caring responsibilities.
Yeah,
and then
there are
some other requirements that providers and people that deliver disability services are also represented on that committee. Mm-hmm. So the IAC, an independent committee that provides advice to board primarily, has a really strong spread of people that have lived experience of disability.
Mm. So with the IAC and with the minister and some of the other constituents, so with, when you're talking about the legislation with the scheme itself, so there's still room for change as this rolls out, like with, because I know to pass bills it can be a little bit tricky depending on what it is and why, but is there continuous improvement in that sector as well?
So in terms of improvement of the legislation
yeah.
So that there absolutely is. Since the legislation was put in place in 2013, there's been tweaking and improvement. There's been some modest adjustments to the legislation to reflect how it's all unfolding in reality. Most of the improvements that we make to the system don't actually require legislative change. They require changes to our own rules and processes. But at the moment, there is a big legislative reform project going on. So in August, government announced that there would be a complete review of the NDIS Act with a particular focus on how the participant experience can be improved and embedded in the legislation with a view to building to the participant service guarantee, which will eventually be in the legislation. So
that's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Mm. And anyone listening to your podcast, I'd encourage them to check out the Department of Social Services website, because there is consultation going on at the moment. And so if they have views about how the legislation might need to be changed or what that participant service guarantee should look like, there's lots of ways that they can be involved in that.
Yeah, that's great. And where are we at now? Like with the rollout of the scheme, like in all the different states and territories, I know in New South Wales and SA, like the majority of that's all rolled out, the scheme itself. And coming off the back of the rollout with the key pathway priorities, where do they lie now?
Yeah. So in terms of where we are now, there are over 300,000 participants in the scheme, and that's pretty extraordinary when you think we've really only been operating at full scheme since 2016. That is huge. So we're now in every state and territory, and in every part of every state and territory except for Christmas and Cocos Islands. So, there's really only a small part left to go. That's very minute. That's right. So we've got, we've got a lot of participants in. There's still more to go. We're thinking we will probably get to about 500,000 in the next five years. So there's still
500,000.
Yeah, so there's still 200,000 people out there that we either haven't come across yet, or perhaps don't even have a disability yet. The scheme is there and available for people that acquire a disability in their lifetime. So we think we'll probably get to about 500,000 in 5 years. At the same time that we're building and building a national scheme, we're improving and reforming what we have in place at the moment. And you spoke about pathways, and I think the focus for pathways, I'm seeing probably three focus areas. The first is around early childhood, early intervention. We've made a number of really significant changes in the last few months to streamline and speed up that process so that kids can get access to the scheme and get the support they need early on. It's very important. I mean, it's the basic principle really for an insurance scheme, that if you can invest early in a person's life, the outcomes that you may be able to deliver down the track, it's potentially extraordinary. Children being able to participate at school. If we can set them up to be able to fully participate in their lives, that's such a good investment.
Yeah.
So early childhood, I think the other area is around complex pathways, where people have a number of disabilities and are in a particularly complex situation, streamlining that process so that they don't need to access supports in a variety of ways, but pulling it all together to streamline that process for them.
Yeah.
And the other area, the other big focus area, I would say, is psychosocial pathways. And for similar reasons, often people with a psychosocial disability are accessing the health system and a range of systems.
Like that can be tricky, when it comes to the psychosocial, but also the complex pathways.
Yeah.
Because when you're looking at invisible disabilities and just the diagnosis and what falls in health or what falls in disability, and just trying to make that the best outcome for that participant in the disability realm, but trying to have health involved as well. So.
Yeah, I think that's really true about invisible disabilities. Its own challenges that come along with that. I often talk to my staff and my team and my colleagues about the fact that when you live with disability, either yourself or you're caring for someone with disability, every decision that you make in your life requires, you know, 10 times more decisions, you know, where to go out, how to, when you're traveling, you know, every decision requires just so much more thinking and planning ahead. And I turn up to work and I've made 20 decisions about how best to support my son to get him to school. Anything we can do to make that decision-making process simpler and more straightforward for our participants, and particularly those participants that have quite complex needs, that should be our primary focus.
That's great. Yeah, because personally I've been involved with kids going through the Koori court system, and where you got in New South Wales, 73% of the kids that are coming through the correctional facilities that are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander have some sort of disability,
yeah,
which is mainly cognitive, intellectual or mental. And, you know, where it is a lot of that complex psychosocial invisibility stuff going on, and just trying to help guide the pathway through, you know, wherever they're in their correctional facility or their home situation, and trying to best open that pathway up, yeah, so they can get, you know, the access request form in, and but trying to substantiate everything as well, like with the health professionals to,
yeah,
get the diagnosis over the line. And sometimes, you know, it is tricky, because when you're talking to the people within the NDIA offices, like the local offices, and trying to convey, you know, what's reasonable and necessary for this complex situation. But it's great to hear that the agency is really, you know, working on, you know, those three pillars to do with the early intervention, the complex and the psychosocial. I think that's huge, very important, and I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, good. Yeah. I think when anyone's experiencing, they're having to deal with multiple government agencies and at different levels, it's tricky to navigate. It's why NDIS is really important, and why I find it particularly extraordinary, because it's a partnership between the Commonwealth and the states and territories. So there are lots of services that the states and territories will always provide to people with disability in the same way they've provided to anyone else living in a particular state or territory. So health, education, transport. The more we can do to make the interface with that and the NDIS clearer, I think that's really important. And in the last few weeks, there's been a lot more, there's been some clarity around the interface between NDIS and disability-related health supports, for example. And when I first saw that was being done, I just thought, this is a game changer for people that have to navigate the hospital system and get questioned about whether they're a participant and what does NDIS fund and what should the hospital fund. Having that clarity is just really important.
That's great.
Yeah.
And with the education also. So
yes.
So does the agency sit down with some of the heads of education and health also, and try and formulate sort of with the participant who's going to fund what and who steps in and who steps away and who owns that space, like for certain individuals that may crop that criteria?
Yeah. So even developing the policy, that was us sitting down with the states and territories and with the heads of health departments and navigating that and working out how can we explain it in a way that's really clear for people. That being said, there's still going to be people that have exceptional cases or particularly unique cases that may not fall neatly into a particular policy description. And in that case, it's really important that the NDIS and its our state offices work really closely with the health or justice or education areas within the state to get the very best possible outcome for the participant. That needs to be what we focus on at all times.
Mm.
Yeah.
And this is a tricky one.
Okay.
So when you're looking at rural and remote, because I know it's hard if you've got, just say if you've got a participant that needs carers or some sort of service, and they're like 2 hours away and they might only need like an hour or two of care, just say.
Yeah.
And then you're not going to have someone that's 2 hours away, like driving, that's going to drive over to do like a 2-hour shift. And because you look at the price guide and some of the incentives and stuff there. Like, it's good, but what does the agency think that the best model is to run in that sphere of when it comes to rural and remote and trying to make that work best? Yeah. Like, when it's got to do with, you know, the professionals, like if it's OTs or doctors that are got to come in and do X, Y, and Z, or if it's a caring agency or whoever it may be, you know, if it's in not just Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities that are way out, but just in rural and remote in general.
Yeah. So the starting point is that anyone, any NDIS participant, so anyone eligible for NDIS support, is entitled to receive the support they need to achieve their goals. Now, that's easy to say, and then in practice, we know that there are challenges with delivering those supports to people that live in rural and remote areas. And that's true for, that's always been true for government, any government service being delivered in a rural or remote area. It's a bit of a challenge. So we're trying to be creative and work out how do we create incentives for people to want to set themselves up in those areas or to travel to those areas to provide services. So in July of this year, we had some pricing increases, and one of those...
I saw that, that was great.
And so you would have seen that one of those increases was for travel. So for the loading, for people to do exactly what you've described, we do want and expect people to travel for 2 hours if that's where the need is. And if, you know, if they're paid for their time, I think that's a pretty good incentive to do that. And if perhaps that there are a number of people that they can deliver a service to in that area, I think that would be an incentive too. So something else we've done recently is we've been a lot more transparent with our data. So we've got a lot of data on our website at the moment about where the demand is for people, you know, where people are wanting particular services. So that maybe, you know, what we're hoping is that the market will look at that data and say, actually, there is a, you know, a block in a particular regional remote area that's unserviced at the moment or underserviced at the moment. It would make good business sense to perhaps travel out there weekly or set ourselves up.
Yeah.
So we're trying to put a lot more information out there in the public to encourage that market to build itself, because the NDIS is around, hopefully, forever. That's my expectation. And so, you know, there are business opportunities for people that are
mine
clever.
Too, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can see it growing in that space and like where you are having the price increase, you know, to have those incentives for folk to, you know, to have an outlook and, you know, try and have a holistic approach too, where, you know, might be a provider that does do X, Y, and Z, like of the different registration groups, where if it's got to do with COS or plan management or what OT or where they might provide all of that, so they can go in and have a look at a collective of, you know, if you've got the data and you can see hotspots of where that people can go out and drive it 2 hours to do that person, and then just up the road they got the next person.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can sort of tick the boxes in that way. That does make sense.
Yeah. But, you know, that being said, it is tricky. I'm certainly not saying we've got it nailed. There's a way to go.
Yeah.
There's quite a way to go. But we, you know, our starting position is that people that live in rural and remote areas should have access to these services if that's what they need. And so we're working out how to make that happen.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And jumping into what's reasonable and what's necessary, because you get a lot of people out there that still get confused with those terms, you know, when they're going into the offices and NDIA offices and talking to the planners and, you know, trying to get the best outcome and, you know, what they should and shouldn't say and to, you know, get it across the line. So if you'd be able to just go along and define what's reasonable and what's necessary for a person that's identified with disability and their plan.
Yeah. So reasonable and necessary is not defined in the legislation, but it really means what can you reasonably and sensibly make a decision that a particular support can assist a person to achieve their goals. So it's always linking back to the goals of the participant and thinking about, you know, what can be supplied, what can be bought, to assist that person to achieve that goal. And so the legislation does list some criteria. So there's things that we need to think about when we're making judgments about what's reasonable and necessary. And, you know, top of that list is what's reasonable and necessary to achieve goals. That's good. That's the top priority. Some other things to think about is whether it's a support that NDIS should fund, or whether it's a support that states and territories are still required to provide. So the fact that a person does have a disability doesn't mean that they shouldn't still be entitled to transport support provided by states. So
yep.
Accessible transport, accessible education opportunities. So there are still services that states and territories provide, and if there is a support that's best provided by the states and territories, that's something we would take into account. Something else we take into account is whether the support or service that's being sought is actually something that people, that families provide to one another, that carers provide, just because they're members of a family. There are some things.
Just a lot of informal support.
Exactly,
like
that's
that.
Right. So there are a range of things that are taken into account. It's not defined. That's probably where, you know, some of the confusion lies. It might almost be easier sometimes to have a description.
Yeah, because there's a lot of grey areas still, yeah. Even though you got black and white and boxes have got to be ticked, there's still grey in between
there
that need to be.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I like a bit. I like black and white and boxes. I like to have a list. But when you think about it, the NDIS is about individualised supports. So one of the risks is if you have, you know, a prescriptive list of what does reasonable and necessary mean, it may not mean that for a person. You know, we look at the individual, we look at their individual needs, and reasonable and necessary may be different in different circumstances. So it's a bit of a toss up between being so prescriptive that everyone has complete understanding but may not be able to fit into that box. I think that's the risk.
That's it. Because when you're looking at the spectrum of all the different disabilities, and like if you've got, say with myself, like you've got it, I'm a C5, C6 incomplete quadriplegic, but the next C5, C6 incomplete quadriplegic is going to have different needs of what fits in the reasonable and necessary, because even though we're the same, but in the same sort of spectrum, there's a lot of different needs, and if it's got to do with equipment or whatever it entails within their disability. And when you're looking at, say, cerebral palsy or autism, just how vast the spectrum is, and just, you got the boxes that have got to be ticked, but there are those little grey areas that you can sort of navigate through and find what best suits for that person and their disability to navigate through the scheme and get what's best that suits
that's right.
their
And that's
disability.
Why the scheme isn't dependent on diagnosis. So you don't get your funding support based on diagnosis, because there is such a spectrum. So any diagnosis doesn't tell you anything about the individual. And that's why, you know, a plan is very individualised. It involves a planner sitting down with the individual and talking about their particular circumstances, the informal supports they already have in place, what their hopes and aspirations are. What a surprise that a person with a disability, the same disability as another person, they're unique. I think it's a beautiful thing that the scheme acknowledges that everyone is unique.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And with individuality, when you're talking about the different types of plans and how they're managed. So when you're looking at agency managed, plan managed, and self-managed, if you don't mind just explaining, you know, what they are and what does the agency think that suits best, like for the agency itself, and just how it works, you know, if the load's a bit too much on the agency, like taking on a lot of the planning, or just what best suits from the agency when it's got to do with those three different pillars.
Yeah. So the reason we have the three different types of management arrangements, plan management, is because everyone is unique, and we're happy for people to pick whatever arrangement suits them best. And it may be that over a period of time you may be you may be plan managed for a while, or you may be agency managed. Your plan may be agency managed, but as your confidence builds, you may actually choose to move into self-management. But then your circumstances may change again, and you may choose to flip between the three, and that's okay. The other thing you can do is have components of your plan that you self-manage, and other bits that are agency managed. So there's a lot of flexibility there.
That's great, having that flexibility.
Yeah, and it's really important. We self-manage my son's plan, and it gives us, you know, it's the ultimate in choice and control, really, isn't it? It's,
yeah.
It's entirely.
Well, that's what the scheme's about.
Yeah. It does, you know. It means that we can choose our providers. We can negotiate prices with our providers. We book and pay for them ourselves. But there is a bit of administration that goes with that. And we've got a responsibility to maintain records and receipts. For some people, that might be that actually might be something that they find difficult, and they might need some help. So the fact that you can have a plan management component in your plan, so you can fund, we can include funding for somebody to assist you in managing your plan. That might be the ideal situation for someone that wants that flexibility to choose their service providers, but wants someone else to manage the paperwork, really.
Yeah, because personally, that's what I do myself. Yeah. I plan manage because, you know, when I'm flat out doing, whatever I'm doing for work, or, you know, it's easier for me to run with the plan manager instead of, because I don't have the time to self-manage. But just with me, that's how it works. So, and it's good having that flexibility of that.
It's fantastic. I think it's really fantastic. We self-manage, but recently in last year, we've elected for a component of my son's plan to be agency managed, because it was around assistive technology, and
That can get tricky.
I thought it was better to outsource that to somebody. So, you know, that's a decision we've made, and that's a fantastic thing that we can have that flexibility to have a plan that meets my son's needs, but that we can run in a way that suits all of my family needs as well.
Yeah, that's great. Now, this has been in the news for the past couple of weeks or a while now, just with the government underspend. Because you've been hearing a lot of people in the media carrying on about it, and, you know, the ups and downs of it. But from the agency's perspective, because the whole scheme itself hasn't been rolled out 100% nationwide, so when you're looking at the dollars stripped out, so how does the agency feel about that, considering that the scheme isn't rolled out 100% and there's going to be more people coming into the scheme and obviously need more dollars? So where's the thought processes in that?
Yeah, you've in part answered your own question, because it's not rolled out 100%, because we're not at that 500,000 number of participants. It means that there is some funding available, because we haven't fully allocated it. You know, what I would, if I could get one message out to participants and their families and their carers, it's that the NDIS is an uncapped scheme. So it's available, and funding is available for anyone that needs it. And the amount of funding will reflect what the needs are of the individual. There's no limit on what that can be. It's about what the individual needs. So I think there's a lot of anxiety. There is a lot of media and public reporting about.
It does create anxiety, that's for sure.
But, you know, what people need to remember is that it's an uncapped scheme. So there will be as much money available as is needed to meet the needs of participants. And as the number of participants increase, I think, you know, the amount of our budget that's absorbed by spending on plans will increase.
Yeah.
When I spoke about the NDIS being a partnership between the states and territories, when it was first set up and the funding model for NDIS, it was based on states and territory estimates of how many people they thought would transition into the NDIS. Now, what we've learned over the 6 years that we've been up and running is that those numbers were only estimates. So the numbers of people that have actually moved into the NDIS didn't hit those estimates. But funding was modelled based on those original estimates. In fact, people are taking a little bit longer to move into the scheme. So you know, estimates are just that. They're based on the very best information available at the time.
And you've got to forecast that.
And you've got to forecast quite a long period of time.
Yeah.
That's right. But the reality's turned out a little bit different. But funding is available for participants that are for eligible participants to meet their needs. And in fact, we've seen the total size of plan budgets increase over the past year. So, you know, the concern that someone is going to take money away from participants is just not playing out in reality. In reality, plan budgets are increasing.
Yep.
Yeah. But I think it's about 15%. I think I saw that in the past year, plan budgets have increased by 15%.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, that is pretty big.
And yeah.
I would hope it would give some reassurance to people out there that are, you know, that are relying on the NDIS.
Yep.
That we're always going to be here to meet the needs of participants. There's just no question about that.
Yeah, that's
great. And government has made that commitment that it will make whatever money available to us in the budget to meet those needs. And that's government on both sides. So I take a lot of confidence from that.
That's good. So with the commitment of not just federal Commonwealth, but when you're looking at all different states and territories with the bilateral agreement,
yeah.
So what's the role with each state and territory and where they play in the scheme and what they have to say and how that, the mechanics of how that works?
Yeah, so you know, most people that are in the scheme have transitioned from a state or territory program. There are still some, you know, some small amounts of people that are still in state and territory programs that will need to transition. So we continue to work with state and territory governments to make sure that happens. I think where we're increasingly working with states and territories now is to identify who are those people that have never been in a state or territory scheme, you know, either because they're young or because they've just never accessed state or territory supports. How do we find them? So they're that hard to reach communities or community that you know, perhaps they're Indigenous,
mm-hmm.
from Indigenous communities, perhaps they're rural and remote and aren't aware of the NDIS, perhaps they're from non-English speaking backgrounds.
Mm.
There's a range of reasons why people have been difficult to access.
Yeah.
Increasingly, that's where we're working with the states and territories to work out how to access those people primarily through targeted communications. So we communicate about the NDIS in different languages.
And just seeing the cultural aspects and needs of
absolutely.
How to approach,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander communities or, you know, some of the communities that are, you know, urban and don't speak English and,
yep.
how to best
yeah.
fit that cultural need to, you know, get what's best for that person or community.
Yeah, spot on. You know, we've recently announced, or government's recently announced, that they would expand what they call a community connectors program.
Okay.
So that's about formalising arrangements between the NDIS and organisations that are already working within communities. So they're not necessarily disability sector organisations, but there are other organisations that have a great community presence. We need to work more with them to make sure we can access people that have been hard to reach up until now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And with accessing people with disability, what's the current percentage when you're looking at the NDIA people with disability that work within the agency?
Yeah.
And is the agency looking at trying to elevate that number and trying to make it the scheme a little bit easier for people with disability to work maybe for the agency, or if it's a part of the, you know, someone's plan if they want to, you know, get into the disability sector, if it's through the agency or whatever it may be, to get amongst that? Because you always see government trying to, if it's people with disability or Aboriginality, to try and elevate those numbers.
Yes to all of your questions, really. There are about 12% of NDIS employees or staff that identify as having disability. That's higher than average for government.
That's good, because I think it's usually I think average is 5%.
I think it's much lower.
Like 3 to 5%,
yeah,
I think.
I think that's right. So 12%, that's people that are declaring that they have, identifying that they have a disability. Then, of course, you have a much bigger group of people, and I fall into that category, of people that have very personal experience with disability. So a carer of someone with a disability, family member, there are large amounts of people in the agency that have that experience. That being said, there's more that can be done to make sure that people that work in the NDIS have a good understanding of disability and different disability types. So even the fact that I have an experience of a particular disability with my son doesn't mean I'm...
Because it's still lived experience at the end of the day.
It's lived experience, that's
right. Yeah, if you've got the disability or yourself with your child that has
that's
a disability.
Right. Yeah, that's right. But even then, it doesn't mean I necessarily understand what it might be like for somebody that has a visual impairment or some other. So there's a lot that we need to do to make sure everyone has an increased understanding of a range of disability types. And we've been working with Dana to build some educational materials to make sure that our planners in particular, but all of our staff, have better understanding, better knowledge about disability types. But we could be doing more to recruit more people with that lived experience of disability. And I think over the coming weeks and months, you'll see that there'll be quite an effort to make sure that happens. We should be employing more people with lived experience of disability, and there'll be a concerted effort to make sure we do that.
Yeah. That's great. The NDIS Quality Safeguards Commission.
Yes.
It's still pretty fresh, the actual commission itself. Yeah. So who are they and what's their role and how does it intertwine with the agency and the scheme?
Yeah, so they're an independent agency and that independence is really important. So they're not part of the NDIS, they're a separate entity. And their role is to monitor, to regulate NDIS providers. So ensuring that the service being delivered by providers is of an appropriate standard and is delivered in a way that is respectful and suitable to the needs of their clients. They do that by investigating, but they also have a bigger proactive role around educating people and ensuring that there is a good understanding amongst providers of standards of service delivery. So they've got a really big educational piece as well as an investigative role as well. So anyone that had a concern about a provider, either about the quality of the service they have provided or the way in which they've provided the service, could contact the NDIS Commission and make a complaint or seek some advice about how best to navigate that. So it's a really important, it's a really important safeguard. Mm. We want participants to be informed consumers, to be empowered and informed consumers. And I think having something like the commission who's there regulating providers, it is a really important safeguard. The commission is now available.
It's a must.
It's a must, of course. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. It's available in every state and territory except for Western Australia, and they're coming on board next year.
Okay.
So, like us, they'll be
a
national scheme.
Yep. And ILC, Information Linkage and Capacity. So what is ILC and the benefits to providers or individuals, participants for this game, and how that can benefit the overall service provision and participants that are within the scheme itself?
Yeah. I often think about ILC as being the means by which we reach potentially all Australians. It's a means by which we might be able to achieve a far more inclusive Australia. So ILC, there are a range of rounds that are aimed at different things. One of the most recent ones was aimed at improving national information and educational products. Now, that has benefit for participants. So if we're getting better products out there, that has benefit for participants. But I like to think too that, the broader Australian public who on a day-to-day basis don't necessarily think about disability because, they're not experiencing it in their life, the more they hear about the NDIS, the experience of participants and the really extraordinary outcomes that participants are achieving, that's combined, that's going to create a more inclusive Australia. I think there's benefits for participants, of course, to be living in an Australia that is more informed, is more accessible, But there's benefits for the broader Australian community of just having that understanding, some empathy and inclusivity. When you create an inclusive space, it's not just inclusive for people with disability.
Yeah.
There are other flow-on benefits. You know, the elderly, as we've got, you know, we've got people, an ageing population, so yes. A more inclusive Australia is going to benefit people that will never be participants.
Yeah, there's so a lot of potential out there.
There is. I think it's quite an extraordinary program, and it's really an investment in an inclusive Australia.
Mm. Yeah, and that's what we want. Inclusive Australia, holistic approach.
Yeah,
and that's how we want to see and view the NDIA.
Yeah,
pushing the scheme out there.
Yeah,
and pushing the scheme out there, and the overall message from the NDIA. Is there something that you want to leave out to the broader community, a message that you want to throw out in the atmosphere that it's going to resonate and, you know, bring down the anxiety levels about the scheme itself and just a positive message you put out there?
Yeah. You know, the NDIS will be there for people with disability now and people that acquire a disability into the future. And that's, you know, that's an extraordinary thing, that safety net that we don't see anywhere else in the world, knowing that Australia has made a decision to invest in supporting people with disability. It gives me immense pride as an Australian, not just as a parent of a child with a disability. You know, the key message there is that funding will be available to support people that need the support to achieve their aims and objectives, their goals and objectives. And I think that's something that we should be celebrating. There is a way to go. So there is a way to go. But, you know, that was also true for Medicare. You know, Medicare's been around for 40 years and people are still talking about how to improve it. Yeah. I don't think
like any scheme. Of course you're going to have your ups and downs and it's not going to work for everybody like straight away, but you know, as long as you just keep chipping away and like the overall scheme itself, I think it's great.
Yeah,
I know, you know, it works great for me.
Yeah,
and it works for a lot of Australians out there.
Yeah,
but like I said, you're gonna have your ups and downs, but that's like with everything within life. But there are overall scheme itself, it's getting there. It's getting there.
It's absolutely getting there. You know, we know that 90% of our participants say that their experience with the scheme is good or very good.
Mm.
You know, that means that there's 10% for whom that's not the experience, and even that 90%, there is room for improvement for them too. But we're committed to continuous improvement. I don't think we'll ever get to 100%. We're never going to sit back and say our job's done. We're at the point of perfection.
Mm.
As the scheme continues to evolve, as our experience with the scheme continues, we're going to learn more. We're going to adjust and adapt. And I think that's what the Australian public would expect of us, a commitment to continuous improvement.
That's great. Well, Jamie, thanks a lot for sitting down, having a yarn with me. Really appreciate it. Can't wait to get this out in the atmosphere. But social media or contacts with the NDIA, did you want to just throw some of those handles or numbers out there where people can get in contact and, you know, if they're in the scheme now or they're looking at getting into the scheme through the access request forms or whatever it may be, did you want to just throw that out there?
Yeah, happy to do so. So there are lots of ways that people can get information about the NDIS.
Mm-hmm.
Our website is certainly full of information. If anyone wanted to ring our call centre, and particularly if they were wanting to test their access, they could do so. Our number is 1-800-800-110. I hope that's right. I think that's right. So they can do that. They can make appointments to have a meeting with their local, their state office. There's lots of ways that people can get a lot of information about the NDIS. I'd also encourage people to follow us on Facebook. There are lots of terrific stories that we put out there about people's experience with the NDIS and people's experience with ILC grants recipients, not just participants, but broader Australian communities' exposure to the NDIS. So we're on social media, we're on Facebook, we're on the web, or you could just call us, go old fashioned and just give us a call.
That's it.
Yeah.
Get on the blog.
Yeah, that's
right. Have a yarn. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's great.
Good. Thanks, Jake.
Righto. It's great yarn. Look forward to the next one. Hit that subscribe button. Give it a thumbs up. Bet you got some burning questions that should have been asked. So throw it in the comments. Or you can get me via Instagram at streetrollingcheetah or email one word streetrollingcheetah@gmail.com. And want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.